which means they won't even know that I'm the one making inquiries. It took some convincing to assure him you want the car for a very private collection. The undeclared sort. She looked at Remy and smiled. I hope you don't mind that I painted you and Sam as less than savory investors. If it gets us in the door, I'm sure we'll weather the stain on our reputations. That's what I thought. So, what else is new? I see you and Sam are still out traveling the world. You're not feeling the urge to stay home and start a family? Remy laughed as she tried to picture her and Sam settling down with a baby. Let's just say nothing in the immediate future. Plenty of time to think about that later. I'm serious. I worry about you, Remy. Part of me hopes this person doesn't call back. What if something happens to you out there? That old saying, life turns on a dime? There's a reason for it. Remy reached over and touched her friend's arm. We're careful. And you know Sam. He's not going to let anything happen to me. Georgia looked up as John climbed the steps from the garden, followed by Oliver, Chad, and Sam, who was carrying two bottles of Chianti. Speaking of, here's your fearless husband now. Sam placed the bottles on the table, then brushed his hand on Remy's shoulder as he took the chair next to hers. What are you two talking about? Or do I want to know? Georgia's phone rang. She leaned forward, nearly spilling her drink as she scooped it up to check the caller ID. It's him. Who? Sam asked, as Oliver and Chad took a seat in the remaining chairs, while John opened a bottle of wine. Her contact, Remy whispered. About the cars. Georgia signaled for them to stay quiet while she answered, her Italian so rapid fire, Remy had a hard time keeping up until she switched to English, saying, They're here with me now. I'll check. Georgia pressed the mute button on her phone. If you can make it to Rome, he says his friend is willing to meet somewhere public, but no large crowds. Remy? Sam asked. She knew the perfect restaurant. Ask him if he's familiar with Osteria Antica Roma on the Appian Way. Georgia repeated the location. Very good. Ciao. She hung up, telling them he'll meet you there tomorrow at noon. Tomorrow? Remy said. That makes it difficult to get to the other auction. What auction? Sam asked. Milan, Georgia said, telling him about the event. Sorry to say, Sam said, we can't be in two places at one time. Oliver and I can go to the Milan event, Chad said. If it turns out to be nothing, no time wasted. Remy checked Oliver, noting his hands clasped tightly on the arms of the chair. The poor man looked ready to bolt, and she could hardly blame him. Are you okay with that? She asked. He took a deep breath, squared his shoulders, and said, If it helps with my uncle's case, then yes. Looks like we have our itinerary for tomorrow, Sam said. Chapter 40 The early morning sun poured through the window as Arthur Oren watched his son, not quite two, crawling beneath the table to retrieve a plastic block that had landed there. Arthur Jr. would inherit everything one day, including all that Oren had added to the family fortune, and all that he'd soon acquire from the Peyton side of the family. The boy picked up the bright red block, looked over at his father wide-eyed, placed the corner of the block in his mouth, babbling something unintelligible. His ever-present nanny bent down and pulled the toy out. No, AJ. A little dirt won't hurt, Oren said, reciting what his mother had always told him. Yes, sir, she said, then distracted AJ with a stuffed bear. The boy crawled over, reaching for it, saying, Baba. Bear, she corrected. Baba, the child demanded, as the phone rang. Bruno's number showed on the screen. Oren waved at the nanny to take the child from the room. The moment the door closed, he picked up the receiver. Did you get it? It wasn't the ghost. What do you mean it wasn't the ghost? Did no one look? They used smoke and mirrors. Had us fooled. He sat there, seconds ticking on a wall clock behind him, hoping he'd misunderstood. But the long stretch of silence on the other end told him otherwise. What happened? He listened as Bruno went over the details. The moment Orin heard the Fargos mentioned, he bristled with anger. How is it those two keep finding their way into the middle of my business? You don't think they stole the ghost, do you? He considered the possibility. I doubt they'd go to the trouble of concocting a fake car if that were the case. Why not? They're all about money. Fool us. Keep the car, and who's the wiser? Except that Orin had read enough about the Fargos to know otherwise. They're too altruistic. They wouldn't risk someone's life over material possessions. At least we can cross them off the list. You don't think Colton has it? Of course not. He swiveled around in his desk chair, glancing at the clock on the wall. Colton was due any moment now. Take another look around Peyton Manor. There's a lot of barns that aren't being used anymore. After all, they found the car in one of them. Maybe he has it there. Won't be able to get out there until tomorrow, Bruno said. Had to take Frank to get his arm stitched. Someplace where they wouldn't ask questions about gunshots. Just do it, he said, hearing footsteps outside the door, then a soft knock. I have to go. He dropped the phone in its cradle just as Colton walked in, making a wide berth around the red and blue plastic blocks on the floor. No smoking, Orin said as the man started to pull out a cigarette. Not with my son in the house. Doesn't your ex normally keep the boy? He asked, returning the cigarette to the pack. She's on a trip. Colton pulled out a chair in front of the desk, using his foot to clear the blocks from the floor in front of him before sitting. I take it your attempt to recover the car wasn't successful. Unfortunately, no, he said, thinking about Bruno's suggestion that Colton was behind the theft of the ghost. The very idea that the person he'd paid to steal it in the first place was perhaps responsible for stealing it a second time on the sly. It seemed absurd. Turns out the car was a fake. You think this mechanic took it? I'd say it's highly unlikely. The Fargos were involved, and I don't see them risking anyone's life for a car, no matter how valuable. Colton, who'd been eyeing the toys scattered about the room with an expression bordering on distaste, suddenly looked up at him. What do you mean the Fargos were involved? My men planted themselves in the mechanic's house with his mother. Leverage. Are you insane? It worked. How? You still don't have the car. You're lucky the police weren't called. Colton reached out, kicking one of the blocks at his feet. The red plastic square rattled across the floor, landing in front of Orin's chair. Another fool move like that. Your kid'll be visiting you in prison, assuming your ex lets him near you. Are you threatening me? Far from it. Since you're the one paying my salary, it's in my best interest to make sure you stay out of jail. My men were acting on credible evidence that the mechanic had the car. Credible? Who was your source? Allegra. Colton's brows went up slightly. Oliver's sister. Interesting. By any chance, did she volunteer this information out of the blue? Of course not. I called her and asked. Clearly she was wrong, but her guess seemed logical at the time. After all, this Chad fellow was the man who helped Albert and Oliver ready the car for the London show. Colton absently reached for his cigarette pack, suddenly remembered, lowered his hand. Did it ever occur to you that she was being a little too helpful? I asked her who she thought was good for it. What about that ex of hers? If not for him, we wouldn't have had the ghost at all. Besides, he's nothing but a petty crook. I doubt he has the means to pull off such a thing. You are sure? At the moment, Orin wasn't sure of anything, except the nagging thought that Colton had all the advantages in this venture. Despite Bruno's suggestion otherwise, it occurred to Orin that there was really no one he could trust but himself. For one, Allegra doesn't drive. Two, unless she's suddenly flush with cash, she'd never be able to have the funds to hire someone to steal the ghost. Three, do you really think she could somehow have gotten past your security? Strike that last question. Apparently, someone did. There was nothing wrong with my security. Except for that one glaring flaw. The ghost was in your warehouse, and it's now missing. We'll find whoever was behind the theft. That you can count on. In fact, I have a very good lead in Italy. What lead? A silver ghost that suddenly just came on the market. An auction for very select clientele. You think it might be the Grey Ghost? We can't be sure, but the timing is highly suspect. If there's any possibility that it is the ghost, you'll need to get on it before Oliver or the Fargos hear about it. The last thing you want is to cross swords with them. On this, they agreed. That Oliver had taken up with the Fargos to help save his uncle's home was beyond infuriating. For someone who'd never shown any interest in getting married and producing an heir, the man was a sentimental fool, protecting his uncle's estate, even though he had no one to pass it on to except Allegra's son. I wish we could put an end to his relationship with the Fargos. Their interference is costing me time and money. Do you think they know why you're after the ghost? Does it matter? It might. Maybe if we found the ghost and it was returned to Peyton, they'd back off. Quite right, Orin said. Let's give a car worth millions upon millions to the very man I've spent the last year trying to financially ruin. Brilliant idea. Do you have any more scintillating plans you haven't revealed? No one said you had to give it to him in one piece. Have you taken leave of your senses? Orin replied, wondering if he should rethink his dismissal of Colton as the mastermind behind the theft of the stolen ghost. Only an idiot would purposefully ruin a car worth tens of millions of dollars. It's not like you can sell it on the open market. Maybe not, but there are plenty of buyers who'd make a private sale for their own collection just to say they have it. Isn't that how you found the auction for this ghost in Italy? Colton merely regarded him with those dead brown eyes of his. The man was infuriating. Returning the Grey Ghost is not an option. I intend to recover it. Period. Orin leaned back in his chair, taking a moment to calm himself. Back to the Fargos. I'd prefer they were dead. How do you plan on taking care of it? As I said before, killing them outright will only bring unwanted attention. There's a far better way to keep them out of your affairs, and later, when they end up dead. Anyone who hears what happened will nod in understanding at how two young, once wealthy socialites took their own lives. In fact, I've already started implementing it. I'm listening. Chapter 41. Journal of Jonathan Peyton, 5th Viscount Wellswick, 1906. I still held out hope that my cousin was innocent. Even so, I dared not let him get past. How would I explain Isaac Bell's presence in the headmaster's office? And what of the boy Toby? I couldn't let Reginald see him. I knew I must have seemed as though I'd suddenly lost my wits, standing there, my tongue cleaved to the top of my mouth. As a look of annoyance crossed Reggie's face, I was vaguely aware of Miss Atwater's melodic voice drifting out of the classroom as she taught the alphabet. It was clear. I was smitten. A year ago, my father had arranged for a proper introduction to an heiress of his approval, hoping our betrothal would soon follow. Suffice it to say that Reginald was now married to the young woman, my father pointing out that he'd only courted her because of my interest. The truth was that I was happy for him. She and I would not have made a good match. Miss Atwater, however, she was different, and part of me was reluctant to use her as my excuse for being here. I wouldn't have. Except that Reggie's mild annoyance started turning to suspicion. "'Tis rash," I said to Reginald. "I know. But I came back, hoping to catch a glimpse of Miss Atwater. And now I feel the fool. She never even noticed me on our first visit. Perhaps because she'd never seen me. I tried drawing Reggie away. Please, don't look in there, lest she notices us. Accompany me outside." "To what purpose?" Reginald asked, looking past me into the classroom. I grasped his arm, guiding him down the hall, then out the door. "To work up the nerve to ask if she would consider allowing me to call on her." I paced in front of the carriage, pretending. Nay, there was no pretense whatsoever. I was so besotted that I needed help with what I should say to Miss Atwater. Reginald was at once amused and annoyed. "She's a school teacher, and a bit long in the tooth. Do you sincerely think she wouldn't be flattered by your attention?" I ignored his assessment of the woman, whom I found perfect. "And what if she says no? Either declare your intentions and risk your father's wrath, or go back to being the coward you are, and never knowing what may happen." Reginald had always been braver, stronger, faster, smarter. As children, I had often been the one to hang back, let my cousin take charge. It was easy to fall into that role now because I needed to keep Reginald out here, away from the headmaster's office. But the truth of his words stung. I had always allowed my father to run roughshod over my interests, Reginald's too. And so, when I asked for pointers on how to approach Miss Atwater, I was very serious. How do I do it? Before Reginald had a chance to answer, Isaac Bell came striding around the corner. He didn't look at me or my cousin until he was nearly on us, and all he did was tip his hat and continue past as though he knew me not at all. I was fortunate that, at that very moment, Miss Atwater appeared at the top of the stairs, drawing our attention away from Bell. "Sir," she said. I was lost in her blue eyes, and it was a moment before I realized she was addressing me. "Pardon?" "I wanted to thank you for insisting the young ladies being brought into the classroom." Reginald gave me a sly look. "Happy to oblige," I said, thrilled that she'd seen fit to seek me out. She gave the slightest of curtsies, about to leave. "Miss Atwater." She turned back, looking at me with an expectation I wasn't prepared for. After a moment of awkward silence, she said, "I should get back to the children." "Would you do me the honor of allowing me to call on you?" My words came out in a rush. "Even so," she smiled shyly, saying, "I would find that most agreeable." My delight over the prospect of calling on Miss Atwater was tempered by my reluctance to entertain the notion that my cousin was responsible for the theft of the Grey Ghost. Isaac Bell still believed that Reginald had masterminded the theft while he and I were employed at Rolls-Royce Limited. If so, was he also the masked man who'd held up the train and killed the engineer and brakeman? The embezzlement I could almost believe. The work of a brash man who'd gotten in over his head with gambling debts, especially after Isaac had found proof that the books had been altered. Someone had stolen the money. But murder? All to facilitate the theft of engine parts that Mr. Rolls and Mr. Royce were counting on to finish the half-built Silver Ghost in order to enter it into the Olympia Motor Show instead of the stolen Grey Ghost. As preposterous as it sounded, I dared not mention it to my father, his health being delicate. I tried to put it from my head that night as I called on Miss Atwater, ignoring the strange palpitations of my heart when I thought of her. We ate dinner and took in an operetta, both enjoying ourselves enough that Miss Atwater agreed I could call on her again. She lived in the caretaker's cottage behind the orphanage with her brother and his wife. Neither of us wanted the night to end, so I dismissed my carriage deciding to walk her home. As we strolled down the sidewalk, I sensed the presence of someone behind me. When I looked back, I saw nothing but shadows. "Is something amiss?" she asked. Emboldened by the possession of my father's brass-handled cane, and wanting no harm to come to Miss Atwater, I gathered my courage. "Wait here. I'll be but a moment." I left her at the corner, certain that what I saw in her blue eyes was unwavering trust. Turning back, I gripped the heavy cane and retraced my steps, hoping to discover the source of my unease. Whatever had caught my attention was nowhere to be found, and I chided myself for being so jumpy, certain that my imagination had conjured sounds where there were none. "'Twas nothing," I said, turning back to her. But the street was empty. I ran to the corner, searching frantically, looking at the railroad tracks, wondering if she'd crossed over to the orphanage. "Miss Atwater," I called out. I heard a rustling and started to turn, and then I felt a sharp pain as someone hit me over the head. Chapter 42. The following morning, Chad and Oliver took a train north to Milan, while Sam and Remy made the almost 3-hour drive to Rome to meet with George's contact. Sam turned onto Via Appia Antica, the car bouncing over the cobblestones as they headed up the hill. Neither of them had been to their friend's restaurant since it had moved from its original setting among the ancient Columbaria crypts, and Remy was curious if the new location, on the same road, would have as much character. About 3 miles in, the tomb of Caecilia Metella, built in the 1st century BC, loomed up ahead, the tower overlooking the gardens of the new restaurant. Sam parked the car, and he and Remy walked up the graveled drive, stopping as a tall, dark-haired man carrying a bottle of sparkling wine in a bucket of ice burst out the kitchen door. "Scusi," the man said, almost stepping past them until he made eye contact. "Remy, Sam, wait here, I'll be right back," he added, his Italian accent thick. Paolo Magnanimi continued past them into the garden, where customers sat at white-cloth-covered tables, some set beneath large white umbrellas, others in the shade of the trees. When he returned, he shook Sam's hand, gave him a big hug, then kissed Remy on both cheeks. "I was very happy to see your names in the reservation list." "It's been too long," Remy said. "I've missed your tiramisu." "But not me," Paolo replied with a laugh. "That goes without saying. Come, I have your table ready." He led them across the lawn to a table set apart from the others. Pink roses grew at the base of the stone ruins that ran the length of the park-like grounds. Paolo pulled out a chair for Remy, while Sam took the chair next to hers, sitting so that his back was to the wall. After exchanging pleasantries, Paolo left to see to his other guests. 45 minutes later, with no word from George's contact, Sam and Remy decided to order without him. They'd just finished their meal when he finally arrived. Luca, as he introduced himself, was dressed in a custom suit, the crisp white shirt open at the collar. He was in his late 40s, his brown hair peppered with gray. "I had hoped to be here before now," he said, sitting in the chair next to Sam's, his dark eyes darting from side to side as he took in everyone seated around them. "I tried calling your mobile, but couldn't get through. I was told you wouldn't leave without me, so I came as soon as I was able." "Don't worry about it," Sam said. "You're here now. Have a bite to eat." "I wish I could, but I really do need to get going." "At least stay for the tiramisu," Remy said. "It's my favorite in all of Rome." As if on cue, Paolo appeared with a third serving of the dessert, which he placed in front of Luca before picking up Sam's credit card. Luca took a bite, his eyes widening. "Oh, that is good." He took another bite, finished it off, before sitting back with a sigh, grateful for the espresso served along with it. "Makes me wish I'd been here for the entire meal." Sam moved the conversation back on track. "Our friend was telling us that you have information on an upcoming auction of an early model Rolls-Royce Silver Ghost." "Please don't take this the wrong way. I took the liberty of looking into your backgrounds on the internet. You seem like a nice couple, unlike the people who generally attend. They don't care much about where the car came from or returning lost property to its rightful owner. In fact, some of them are as likely to kill to get what they want as they are to pull out their checkbooks. We're extremely careful, Sam said. Is documentation provided? Not for this auction. The less documentation, the better. The success depends on the absolute anonymity of the buyers and the sellers. The broker who handles these transactions would never reveal the information. This is, how do you Americans say it? The big league. How do we get in touch with this broker? He studied Sam a moment as though weighing his decision on what he should say. It's 10,000 euros cash, in denominations of 20s, just to walk in the door, if you have an invitation. The latter I can get you for another 10,000. I prefer mine in hundreds. Easier to carry. That's a pretty steep price, Sam said. Take it or leave it. We'll take it. Where do you want to meet? If you have pen and paper. Remy handed both to him as Paolo walked up, whispering something in Sam's ear. I'll be right there, Sam said. Paolo smiled, stood back a few feet as Sam turned to Luca, saying, What time? 9:30. The auction starts at 10. Until then. The address, Luca said, handing pen and paper back to her. Thank you for the tiramisu. I'll see the both of you tonight. With the cash. He pushed his chair back, stood. If I didn't mention, it's black tie. 10,000 euros, Remy said after he left. A small price, if it gets us the information we need, Sam said, as Paolo again walked up, now holding a small machine. He showed Sam the receipt it had printed. Declined, Sam said. He handed Paolo a different card. That was also declined, as was Remy's. Paolo gave them an apologetic smile. Sometimes these machines are finicky. Don't worry about it. Maybe some computer glitch somewhere. Sam paid with cash instead. We better call Selma, Remy said, taking out her cell phone. If anyone can figure it out, she can. Her call wouldn't connect. Luca did say he couldn't get through to us. Maybe we're too far out from the city center. You try, Sam. He did. Same result. Hate to bother you, Paolo. May I borrow your phone? Of course. Right this way. Sam and Remy followed him across the lawn. Remy waited outside while Paolo showed Sam the phone, then left to attend to customers. Sam returned about 5 minutes later, his expression diplomatically neutral. Paolo saw him walking over. Is everything okay? Just a mix-up at the bank. Glad I had enough cash to cover lunch. Remy gave Paolo a hug. The meal, as always, was fabulous, and I absolutely love your new location. She waited until they were well out of earshot before asking, Did you find out what was going on? Not even close. I spent the last few minutes with one of the credit card companies who informed me that I'd canceled that card about an hour ago. I assured her I hadn't. She didn't believe you? Even worse, she didn't believe I was me. How is that possible? Not sure. I couldn't reach Selma or Laszlo. Busy signal. Remy held up her phone as they walked to the car, hoping to find some connection. This doesn't make sense. They've worked here before. She looked over at Sam. What do you mean, a busy signal? We have call waiting.
Exactly.
What's going on?
It's time we find out.
Chapter 43 Sam unlocked the car doors, opening Remy's, before walking around to the driver's side. He started the engine, the air conditioner blasting, then took off down the road, going over all the possibilities of how and why their cards were declined. Not quite the same, but what came to mind was that Oliver and his uncle had suddenly found themselves destitute, which was what led to them selling off their possessions and putting Peyton Manor on the market. While Oliver had naturally assumed that his uncle was somehow responsible, Sam now believed otherwise.
I hate to say it, Remy. There's only one reason I can think of that all this is happening.
That would be? She asked, holding her cell phone at various angles, still trying to get a signal. Every account frozen. No access to money or credit.
Sound familiar?
She looked up in alarm.
You're saying someone hacked our accounts? How vulnerable are we?
Right now, our biggest problem is being stuck in a foreign country with no assets. If that's the case, it could take days or weeks to sort through it all.
Remy's moment of panic was over, her expression turning to one of determination.
If they're targeting us, we're on the right track. Or it could just be that we're helping the Paytons and someone wants to stop us.
Or both. We definitely need to talk to Selma.
And if we can't get in touch with her?
We need to get into that auction. We need cash.
And the proper clothes to get into a black tie affair.
I'd say a quick trip to the airport. Get some money, our satellite phone, and clothes from the jet that'll get us into the auction. We'll figure out what's going on from there.
When they arrived at the airport, what they didn't expect was to find their jet locked in a hangar with no sign of their crew. When they tried to get access, a uniformed security guard was called, the young man standing quietly behind a dark-haired female clerk who was hesitant to tell them the jet was being held for non-payment, and any access forbidden until the bill was paid.
How? Sam asked. It was paid before we arrived.
My apologies, Mr. Fargo, but the account has been frozen, and the credit card charges reversed. When we tried to contact you by mobile, you didn't answer. We had no choice. Unless, of course, you are here to make the payment.
Something he couldn't do, since neither he nor Remy had a credit card that would work.
Any chance we can get on the jet?
Unfortunately, it's beyond my control.
We'll get the money, Sam said, once I know the jet's safe. And my crew.
They haven't been in touch. Your pilot assured us he'd be in touch with you to straighten this entire matter out.
Sam and Remy exchanged worried looks, Sam saying, can you at least show us the jet?
How do I know it's still there?
The young guard stepped forward.
I'm sorry, Mr. Fargo, but until payment is made, I'm going to have to ask you and your wife to leave the airport. We would appreciate if you did so quietly.
Sam didn't know Italian law, whether the lockdown of their jet was standard procedure for unpaid bills or manipulation by whoever had hacked their accounts mattered little. Their inability to access their aircraft was going to make life a lot harder. Probably the very reason behind it. Short of storming the hangar, not an option with the number of armed guards stationed at the airport, he thanked them for their time. As he and Remy started to turn away, she reached over, placing her hand on Sam's arm.
What about my medication?
He looked over at his wife, her expression so open and vulnerable, he almost believed she was in dire medical need. Sam turned to the security guard, doing his best to appear worried about her health.
Can you at least escort my wife onto the plane to get her pills?
The guard eyed Remy, then the woman behind the counter, who gave a slight nod.
Just make sure that's all she removes, the woman said.
Let me get my cart, the guard said. I'll drive you out there.
When he returned with the electric cart, Sam started to follow Remy, but the woman held up her hand.
Sir, you'll have to wait here. I'm bending the rules enough by allowing your wife onto the plane. Please, don't make me lose my job.
He walked across the gray linoleum tiles to a row of hard plastic chairs to wait. 15 minutes later, the guard and Remy returned. Remy wearing what looked like a black silk scarf draped artfully around her neck.
Grazie, Remy said to him. She took Sam's arm and the two left.
Sam regarded the very long scarf around her shoulders, noting the Valentino label just visible in one of the folds. No suit or black tie?
One slinky gown and the sat phone was all I could manage without him noticing. The petty cash box was empty.
Hopefully the crew took it. We at least know they'll have enough to survive on for the next few days. Their credit cards are on the same business account as ours.
Where do you suppose they are?
Sitting in some air-conditioned hotel, sipping Prosecco,
attempting to contact Selma to get this straightened out, which is what we need to do as soon as possible. Sipping Prosecco. As tempting as that part of the plan is, we might want to hold off until we figure out what's going on. The two walked out, the heat hitting them full force when they left the cooled building, waiting for the shuttle that would transport them to the parking lot.
I don't get this, Remy said, once they were in their car.
She untied the dress from around her neck, tossing it into the back seat.
How could it happen?
Does it matter? He backed out of the parking space, the wheels squealing on the slick concrete as he turned. We move on. He paid the parking fee, waited for the cashier to wave him through, then pulled out into traffic, noticing a black Mercedes right behind him. He made a lane change. The Mercedes did the same. Time to check that sat phone. She turned it on and tried to make a call.
Nothing.
No doubt about it. Whoever targeted them had covered all the bases. They were definitely pros, maybe someone with military or counterterrorism experience. Sam sped up to get around a van. The Mercedes did the same. He checked his rearview mirror, just able to make out the silhouette of the man driving it, recognizing the flat-top haircut. Unlock that glove box and get your gun. We're being followed. Chapter 44 Sam's attempt to lose the Mercedes failed when a second car, also a Mercedes, this one dark blue, pulled up behind them. The two cars kept a steady pace. Remy placed her gun in the center console, shifted in her seat to see who was behind them. That's the same man who followed us from Peyton Manor to Chad's mother's house. He let up on the gas, hoping for a better view. When he looked in the mirror, he recognized Bruno's ruddy face. Sam sped up. You know what I find fascinating about this?
Fascinating?
Not a word I'd associate with suddenly being destitute and being followed by whoever these people are. Interesting, then. Much better word choice, she said, watching the side mirror. Someone hacks our account. We head to the airport, and they're there waiting for us.
I don't find that fascinating or interesting. I find it disturbing.
They knew we'd be coming here. Our jets here. All they had to do was wait in the parking lot, and there we were. Remy looked over at him. You are going somewhere with this, or just pointing out that we're in trouble. If they've hacked into our accounts, our phones, our credit cards, they have access to every charge we made. When we tried using the credit cards at Paolo's restaurant, they knew exactly where we were.
Why didn't they just follow us from there?
That's what I was wondering. If I had to guess, the hack was very recent. He checked his mirrors. The two cars were keeping a pace, but maintaining their distance. If that's the case, there wasn't enough time for them to get to the restaurant. She looked over at him. Logical guess is we'd head to the jet for whatever we need?
Exactly.
Well, I think your hypothesis is nearly flawless. How is that going to help us? We need to regroup. Once we lose them, we have to figure out how to stay off the grid.
We're broke, Sam.
We're going to have to figure out how to survive. He thought about what he had left in his wallet after paying for lunch that afternoon. 200 euros isn't exactly broke. Unless, of course, you're trying to come up with something to wear to an event where you have to look like you can afford to be there.
The party and auction are black tie, with one dress between us. We're going to have to draw straws to see who wears it.
Not sure I can pull off black silk.
Definitely not sleeveless black silk.
He switched lanes again. The least of our problems right now. We don't even have the 10 grand to get in, never mind the 10 grand Luca wants for his invitation. He looked over at her, then back at the road, his eye on the two cars following them.
Don't you find it odd that they're just hanging back? Not even worried about staying on our tail, or speeding up when we do.
I do find that odd, especially considering the way you managed to elude them on our way out of Manchester.
They have to be tracking us somehow.
Possibly our cell phones. Remy made sure both phones were turned off.
The two cars were still following at a safe distance, even with Sam doing his best to lose them.
"We can't go back to George's," Remy said. "We'll lead them right to her."
She was right, of course. We seemed to be one step behind. Time to turn things around. He hit the gas, pulled off the motorway, went back the other direction, took the next exit, headed down a long stretch of road, feeling as though he'd managed to lose the tail, until he noticed a car, so far back it was just a speck, but coming closer, until the blue Mercedes filled his rearview mirror. No sign of Bruno's black Mercedes. Still, Sam's evasive maneuvers should have worked to lose both cars, not just the one. "We know it's not the phones. Makes me wonder if they somehow put a tracking device on our car while we were at the airport." Remy tapped her fingers on the slide of her weapon. "I could take out one of his tires." "I'm not sure that'll help. Bruno's car is still out there. If they did put on a tracking device, at least we can slow him down. One tail is better than two." Sam eyed the narrow road winding through the low foothills, the rolling slopes covered with brown grass. This far out in the country, there wasn't a house in sight. In fact, they were the only two cars on the road. No innocent bystanders to get hurt. No witnesses. And no police. "If we're going to do this, now's the time." Remy's green eyes sparkled with cat-like anticipation as she finger-combed her red hair into a ponytail, rolled down her window, shifted in her seat to face the rear, gripping her SIG in her left hand. She braced it on the base of the frame of the open window. "Ready any time, Fargo," she said over the wind. Sam let his foot off the gas, slowing for a curve. The blue Mercedes gained on them. When it tried to pull alongside their car, Sam veered to the center, refusing to give it room, as he accelerated out of the curve. "Get ready," he said. "A straight stretch ahead." He sped up. Remy leaned out the window, her hair whipping at her face as she took aim. He pressed the gas, trying to keep the distance steady, not seeing the pothole until it was too late. Remy fired just as he hit it. "A little warning," Remy called out, her shot missing. "Sorry." He gripped the wheel, steering into another curve, coming out of the turn, realizing too late the one disadvantage of being this far out in the country. Poor road maintenance. Their wheels shuddered across the uneven pavement, jarring Sam and Remy with each bounce. They neared a narrow bridge up ahead, and just beyond it, a sharp turn. "Maybe wait till we get out of this stretch," he shouted. "Where's the challenge in that?" Remy's smile grew even more determined when Sam approached the bridge. She took aim as the Mercedes gained on them, its reflection filling her side mirror. Crack! Crack! The blue Mercedes veered suddenly from the road, spinning in a cloud of dust and debris, slamming into the bridge's parapet. It tilted up on two wheels, seemed to hover for a second, then bounced down the side of the hill. "Nicely done, Mrs. Fargo." "Thank you." Sam pulled over to the side of the road. He and Remy looked out the window and down the hill at the crumpled car sitting at an odd angle at the bottom of the ravine. "You think he survived?" Remy asked. "If he was wearing his seatbelt." Sure enough, they saw movement as the driver tried opening the door. She gave a tired sigh. "As many times as they tried to kill us? It's hardly fair I only got to take out his tire." He pulled out, then continued down the road. Dead bodies with bullets tend to bring the police out in droves. I'd rather not spend hours sitting in an interrogation room, having to explain why we're carrying guns in a country that doesn't allow it. "Good point." He checked the rearview mirror, catching the reflection of the sun on the roof of a sleek black car about a mile back. "Looks like Bruno finally found us. We'd better get out of here before he catches up." Chapter 45. Remy kept an eye on the rearview mirror, watching as the black Mercedes followed at a safe distance. Sam had used every trick taught to him during his time at DARPA, and still hadn't lost their tail, frustrating them both. At one point, Remy opened the sunroof to check the sky. "Okay. We know it's not a helicopter." "Are you sure our phones are turned off?" "Positive." Even so, she opened her purse to double-check the cells and the satellite phone.
They're sitting like bricks in my Hermes bag. You never know. Bricks might come in handy. Well, we know it's not the phones. Like I said, they had to have placed a tracking device on our car when we were at the airport. Remy tapped her finger against the trigger guard of the semi-auto resting on her thigh. It worked once. Let's not push our luck. You sure know how to ruin a girl's fun, she said, keeping her focus on the side mirror. Sam checked the navigation screen on the car's dash. Right now, our best option is to find a place to park and buy enough time to find the device. He drove to the city center, the roads turning more congested as they approached. Horns blared at the taxi drivers veering in and out of lanes, treating the rules of the road more like guidelines in their hurry to get to their destination so they could pick up their next fares. The rest of the cars moved at a snail's pace. At least that gave Remy time to find a location she liked while keeping track of Bruno's Mercedes, stuck solidly three cars behind them. "Find anything?" Sam asked, doing his best to put yet another car length between them. Remy studied the navigation screen, using the toggle switch to zoom out, trying to find an area that might work. Her eyes landed on the Piazza del Popolo and the three streets that branched out from it like a trident. Just beyond it was the Piazza di Spagna, a location she knew quite well. She pointed to the map. "You know that little street near the Trident where we park when we come here to shop?"
"You mean when you come here to shop?"
He glanced at the screen. "Sorry to say, it's not registering in my memory bank." "Funny, Fargo. You've waited for me enough times. It's just down the street from the wine shop you like."
"That I remember. What's your plan?"
"Find a place to park. I draw him out. Have him chase me. You find the tracking device."
"I'd feel better if he was chasing me, not you."
"Except he's more likely to think I'm the easier prey. Once you find the tracking device, you come pick me up. Hopefully before he catches me." He cocked a sandy brow at her.
"Hopefully?"
"Just trying to be helpful, Fargo. After all, you didn't want me to kill him.
Assuming you still want to avoid the police?"
"And where am I picking you up?" "The top of the Spanish Steps." Sam peered at the map on the screen, thought about it a moment, nodded.
When they were a couple of streets away from the Piazza di Spagna, Sam zipped down a narrow street, pulled over, and parked the car, angling it in a space barely big enough.
Remy caught a glimpse of the black Mercedes parking at the end of the street as she and Sam quickly walked the opposite direction, then ducked into the corner wine shop. The advantage and disadvantage of their location was that there were no doors, the interior of the shop wide open to both streets, allowing them to see anyone coming from either direction. Sam, his back to the entry, picked up a slim bottle filled with a pale yellow liquid, pretending to read the label. Remy kept watch, seeing Bruno jump out of his car and race down the street in their direction.
"He's on his way," she said, catching sight of the bottle of limoncello in Sam's hand.
"Try not to forget we're here for a purpose."
He grinned.
"Me?"
Remy stepped out, taking a quick peek, surprised when she saw Bruno racing toward her one moment, then suddenly stop in the middle of the block, searching the crowded street for them. Unsure of which direction they'd gone, he returned to their rental car, intending to wait by it until their return. She hefted her purse higher on her shoulder, feeling the weight of the three phones in it, wishing she'd had the foresight to leave them in the car. Too late for that, she watched as Bruno settled against the wall in front of their car, clearly in no hurry. This was not going according to plan.
"Something wrong?" Sam asked from his position inside the shop.
She gave an exasperated sigh.
"Apparently he's decided to wait for us."
Several seconds, then minutes, ticked by.
"He's just standing there," she said.
"He knows we need to get back to that car."
Sam returned the bottle of limoncello to the shelf, moved to her side, and peered over her shoulder.
"You could always go out there and pretend to be lost."
"That should work. See you at the top of the stairs, Fargo."
She leaned over, kissed him, and went out to the sidewalk, craned her head back as though searching for a street placard high up on the side of the building. From the corner of her eye, she saw Bruno standing there, arms crossed, staring straight ahead.
She stepped out farther, turning around as though lost. But the man remained planted like a Roman statue next to their car, never once turning her way. Frustrated, she walked past the shop's entryway, ignoring Sam's grin as he watched from inside. Not helping Fargo. Maybe less subtle? He was right. She did her best to look like a deer caught in the headlights as she stared at Bruno, shouting, "Sam, there he is! Run!" Bruno looked up at the sound of her voice. The moment he saw her, he pushed off the wall, sprinting in her direction. Chapter 46. Remy waited a second or two longer than she should have, just to be sure Bruno saw her turn the corner. Keeping to the middle of the street, where she wouldn't be missed, she dashed past shoppers ogling the fashions displayed in the windows of the designer stores. Finally, she reached the piazza, turning left toward the Fontana della Barcaccia, only then realizing the bigger danger. Disappearing into the midst of hundreds of tourists milling about the boat-shaped fountain and gravitating toward the very steps she needed to get to. If Bruno lost sight of her, he might end up turning back to the car. And Sam. Somehow, she was going to have to keep him close enough for him not to lose sight of her. But as soon as she found a corridor between people to run through, the crowd swarmed in, closing the gap. Frustrated, Remy stopped at the railing of the fountain, leaning against it, pretending to be out of breath, waiting for him to catch up. The moment he saw her, she jumped back, trying to appear frightened, and darted into the piazza, running toward the Spanish steps. The 135 steep stairs, built in 1723, led up to the Trinita dei Monti Church and the street that paralleled it, where she hoped Sam would be waiting with the car. She burst out of the crowd and across the piazza, glancing back to make sure he'd seen her. This time there was no doubt. He followed, shouldering aside a camera-wielding woman who got in his way, ignoring her shouting as he raced past, trying to catch up to Remy, who'd already started up the right side of the stairs. About halfway up, she looked back and saw Bruno gaining on her. The purse, with the phones and her Sig Sauer, felt as heavy as a boat anchor. Hefting the bag onto her left shoulder to give the other shoulder a rest, she pushed on, feeling herself slowing from fatigue. When she surveyed the stairs above, there was no one clear path up. The crowd shifted, people suddenly sitting in front of her, posing for photos, with the twin towers of the church at the top. They paid little attention to Remy as she tried to run past, suddenly having to change course because they changed positions for a better shot with their cell phones or cameras. Her quads burned by the time she reached the top. A vendor selling cold water held a bottle dripping with condensation out toward her. Not even having enough breath to tell the man no, she looked back, saw Bruno about 20 steps below her, slowing down, but not nearly enough room for her comfort. Traffic in front of the church was one way, which meant Sam would have to come from her right on Via Sistina and either continue straight past the church and the Spanish steps to the left, or make a sharp hairpin turn onto Via Gregoriana, which would bring him back the way he came. Certain he'd stay on Sistina, she immediately headed that direction. But as she searched the street, not seeing him or their car, the flaw in her plan became very apparent. Getting through Rome by vehicle could be a nightmare, especially around the more famous tourist destinations. There was no telling how long she'd have to wait. What she needed was a place to hide. Out of breath, and with no energy to run farther, she ducked into an alcove of one of the shops, hoping Bruno might pass her by. Planting her back to the wall, she leaned over, her handbag slipping from her shoulder. Too tired to do much more than catch the straps, she let the weight of the purse rest on the ground, trying to fill her lungs with air while she waited. It seemed forever before she noticed a shadow on the ground in front of her. Then the sound of heavy breathing, which was almost lost in the heart-pounding pulse in her ears. Without moving, she looked up, saw Bruno blocking her way. They stood there in a stalemate, Remy hoping Sam would pull up at any moment. But after what seemed an eternity, she realized she was on her own. "Got you," Bruno managed as he sucked in air, his sweat-drenched expression one of triumph. He took a step toward her. Remy swung her purse upward. The bag struck his jaw, the phones and gun making a solid thwack. He staggered back, staring at her for one shock-filled second, when she brought her foot up into his groin. As he crumpled to the ground, crying out in pain, she stepped over him, saying, "But I got you better." Chapter 47. Sam pulled up as Remy stepped out from between two buildings. He gave a tap of the horn, leaned over, and opened the passenger door for her. "How'd it go?" he asked. She tossed her purse onto the floorboards as she slid in, wiping the perspiration from her brow.
"There were a lot more steps going up than I remembered."
She took a deep breath, then looked over at him.
"Did you find it?"
He tapped the center console, where the small magnetic tracking device and its now-removed battery sat in the drink holder. Tucked inside the bumper.
"I would have tossed it onto the back of a police car."
"Thought about it," he said as Remy closed her eyes, her breathing fast and shallow. "But it might come in handy. If we need them to track us, we can always put the battery back in." Sam saw the man at the top of the steps, selling water. Foot on the brake, he idled toward him, rolling down the window. "I'll take a bottle."
€1, the man said, holding up the dripping bottle.
€1, Remy said. "I can wait." Sam ignored her, digging the coin from his pocket.
"Grazie," Sam said, taking the ice-cold bottle and giving it to his wife. "I'm not the one who just did the 300-step dash."
"Half that number. And we're broke, in case you forgot." She held the bottle up to her neck.
"Even so, I love you for this."
He checked the mirrors, saw Bruno struggling to his feet. "Time to get out of here. Our friend's stirring," he said, watching the man lean over, hands on his knees, looking as though he might be sick. Remy glanced back again.
Guess I didn't hit him hard enough.
She twisted off the bottle top, taking a long drink.
"Any thoughts on how we're going to swing this auction without the buy-in fee?"
"I figured we'd just show up."
"And what good is that going to do? Even if we could convince Luca to let us in without the money, it's black tie. Or need I remind you that your dress clothes are being held for ransom with our jet?"
"We are dressing in black, if that counts." Remy's smile held a hint of devious mischief as she settled back, buckling her seatbelt.
"That's what I love about you, Fargo. Even on a budget, you know how to show a girl a good time."
They arrived just after 9 at the broker's house at the top of a hill about an hour outside Rome. Luca wouldn't be expecting them for at least another half hour, with the beginnings of a plan in hand.
"No wonder he charges so much to get in," Remy said as Sam drove up the winding road.
The palatial-sized villa, taking up the entire hilltop, overlooked the lights of Rome in the distance. The sky glowed a muted gray gold from the late summer sun, dipping below the horizon. Judging from the number of cars parked in the graveled lot on the south side of the estate, most of the guests had already arrived. An electric shuttle was parked near the gate, two young men in dark suits leaning against the vehicle, one of them laughing at something the other said, until they noticed Sam and Remy's car. The younger of the two walked over, leaned down, looking in the driver's window, moving from Sam to Remy, then down to their clothes. Before he had a chance to comment, Sam nodded his head toward Remy, saying, "Ristoratore." The young man gave a knowing smile, pointing to the left, telling them to check in with the guard at the back gate.
"Grazie," Sam said.
"Caterers?" Remy asked, as Sam drove toward the rear of the house, pulling off to the side, once the shuttle drivers went back to their conversations. At least 50 cars were parked in the lot, which was thankfully sloped away from the house and surrounded by oleanders. The thick bushes, some with white blooms, some with pink, grew high enough to offer cover. Sam grabbed his backpack, took out a pair of binoculars. He and Remy ducked behind one of the oleanders, Remy keeping watch out toward the parking lot, while Sam got a better look at the house. The entire villa, set on the crest of the hill, was surrounded by a high wall topped with shards of glass. Guards manned the gates at the front, where the guests were shuttled to before they'd have to walk up two flights of stairs to get to the front door. He couldn't see the gate around back, but the shuttle driver had mentioned a guard there as well. Several 100-year-old sycamores stood like sentries on this side of the wall, possibly offering a way over. But from here, he had no idea what good that might do.